Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. A worsening cholera epidemic in Haiti has claimed more than 2,000 lives since mid-October. That nation of 9 million also faces a political crisis. Key candidates in last month's presidential election have rejected a recount proposed by Haiti's Election Council. Joining me here in the studio to talk about Haiti, Dr. Anthony Fauci of the National Institutes of Health, joining us from a studio in Virginia, Robert Fatones, Jr. of the University of Virginia, by phone from Doha, Qatar, is Sebastian Walker of Al Jazeera English. And throughout the hour, we'll welcome your questions, comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Dr. Fauci, good morning to you.
Good morning, Dan.
I want to start with you and get you to tell us what is known about this cholera epidemic.
Well, it's a serious situation, obviously. There have been now, it was first recognized just a couple of months ago in October, and now we have approximately 100,000 hospitalizations, about 2,200 deaths. In a situation in which the infrastructure with the poor sanitation, the lack of easily accessible, drinkable, clean water, and that's how this disease is really spread, is from contamination of the water through fecal material, contamination of food. It is a very serious outbreak hitting a country that already has so many other areas in which they're suffering. The cholera is a bacteria, as you know, that causes very profound, acute, profuse, watery diarrhea. The difficulty with it is that it's so acute and so dramatic that if you don't get help fast, by help we mean fundamentally rehydration, getting fluid back into you, people have been known to die literally in a couple of hours from the time the symptoms are. It can go for a few days, but some people with a severe form, if they don't get into a medical facility where they can be rehydrated either orally or through intravenous, it becomes a very serious disease.
So where is the bottled water coming from that everybody else seems to be drinking?
Well, as you know, the United States, particularly USAID, PAHO, Médecins Sans Frontières, some of the facilities that are being used for PEPFAR are all working in overdrive down there to try and not only get water to these individuals, but also to provide better sanitary conditions so that you don't have even further spread of this very difficult situation.
Now, what about the reports that this particular strain of cholera was brought to Haiti by UN peacekeepers from Nepal?
Well, you can't say who brought it there, but the molecular fingerprinting that was carefully done by a number of investigators, some from California, including several from Harvard, that was just recently published in the New England Journal of Medicine, have been able to make some definitive statements about where it came from. You can't say who did it. You can't be pointing fingers at this time at all. When cholera epidemics, we're in the seventh historical cholera epidemic right now, and the cholera that began, the seventh epidemic began in 1961, and then by 1991, it got to Latin America, and it has a particular molecular fingerprint. By that, Diana, means that if you look at the makeup of the DNA, you can tell exactly what that particular cholera is. And we know that the cholera that's making people sick now in Haiti is not the cholera that has been in Latin America since 1991. It's molecularly identical to the cholera that we know is in South Asia. That's all we know. We can't say that this person did that or this group did that. We know that it didn't come locally from Latin America.
Dr. Anthony Fauci is director of the NIH's National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Turning to you, Sebastian Walker, I gather you were one of the first reporters to arrive at a hospital near the initial outbreak. Tell us what you saw.
Well, that's right. We were the only TV crew who actually arrived on the scene where the rumor was that the sewage spillage from the base where Nepalese UN peacekeepers were located was actually seeping into a nearby river. Now, this is, I think it was about a couple of weeks after the outbreak actually appeared. So there were cases just downstream, dozens of cases, in fact, in the nearby town of Mirbalé. And what we saw when we arrived at this base, which was located right on the bank of the main river that flows into the town, was a group of Nepalese peacekeepers, UN peacekeeping soldiers, working furiously to try to contain what appeared to be a spillage of sewage that appeared to be coming from latrines. Now, we asked the soldiers who were trying to dig some ditches to, it seemed like, contain the runoff from these latrines. We asked them, you know, are these toilets right there? And they confirmed to us that they were. There was black liquid in pools on the ground that was running from just inside the base down the bank and right into the river. And it certainly looked and smelled like raw sewage. The smell was overpowering. And there were a lot of UN soldiers furiously trying to clear this up. Now, they wouldn't tell us what was going on at that point. It came just after rumors on the local Haitian radio stations that there had been this spillage. And the rumors were that, you know, this is possibly a source of the contamination. And it's actually been backed up by the conclusions of a report by a French epidemiologist who has also suggested that the base, this particular base outside the capital, Port-au-Prince, it's actually in the rural area near the actual heart of where the disease is raging, could actually have been a source of the contamination. So, I mean, I think a lot of questions remain, and we may never actually find exactly what the source was, but certainly what we saw at this base was really just an example of how little oversight there often is in terms of sanitation. You know, this liquid was just flowing into a river where Haitians living downstream use the water for drinking and washing, and they really depend on this source of water, as many Haitians do across the country.
So,
the fact that there was this liquid seeping into the river was certainly worrying.
Tell me about how the hospital itself was able to handle those first patients who were showing up.
Well, it frankly wasn't able to handle just the sheer volume of patients who were arriving. We arrived at the main hospital in the town of San Marc, which is in the rural Artibonite region where the disease first appeared. The day after, reports of dozens of people dying of this mystery disease, which was shortly confirmed afterwards as being cholera. And the scenes were certainly some of the most affecting that I've seen since arriving in Haiti in the aftermath of the earthquake. Just, you know, streams of patients arriving in appalling conditions, had often driven for hours on the back of trucks from remote towns and villages across the region in a state of severe dehydration. We walked into the grounds of the hospital, and the scenes in there were horrific. There were patients, you know, lying everywhere across the grounds of the hospital being treated outside. People were dying constantly. With the short time that we spent in the hospital, we saw, you know, patients dying every 15 minutes or so. It was really a very concerning sight, and really an indication of just what's to come. And now, as we know, the disease has spread around the country, and Haiti is facing a nationwide outbreak of this very serious disease, which, as your doctor was saying, is really just the worst possible development in a country where sanitation standards were already bad even before the earthquake, and now there's this very vulnerable population of more than 1.5 million Haitians living in these very basic IDP camps with hardly any sanitation and very little access to drinkable water.
Sebastian Walker, he's a Haiti-based reporter for Al Jazeera English. which opened a news bureau in Haiti shortly after the January 12th earthquake. Dr. Fauci, back to you. How long has it been since Haiti has experienced cholera?
The last full-blown outbreak of a cholera epidemic was literally a century ago. So it's been quite a while since they've had any serious epidemic of cholera.
And hearing what you've just heard from Sebastian Walker, it would seem that somehow there was a failure of sanitation somewhere along the way.
Well, there's no question that you don't get a cholera outbreak. You can have a sporadic case here and there, but to have an outbreak of this magnitude, it would have to be what we know from the textbooks going back years and years and even historically is poor sanitation, contamination of drinking water and water that gets into food through fecal contamination, just as was mentioned here. So clearly the whole idea of sanitary conditions is an absolute sine qua non to have a outbreak of cholera.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, he's director of the NIH's National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Sebastian Walker is a Haiti-based reporter for Al Jazeera English, which opened a news bureau in Haiti shortly after the January 12th earthquake. When we come back, we'll talk with Professor Robert Baton. He's Associate Dean for Graduate Programs at the University of Virginia. We'll talk about the peacekeepers, the election, and what's to come for that beleaguered nation of Haiti. Stay with us. Welcome back. We're talking in this hour about what's happening to Haiti and in Haiti, both medically and politically. Here in the studio, Dr. Anthony Fauci, I wanted to ask you one more question about how quickly cholera travels.
Yeah. Well, cholera can travel very quickly if you have contamination of water supplies, if you have poor sanitation. It can spread as it did. It started off in one relatively remote area in Haiti. It was in what they call a district or a component. There are 10 of them in Haiti. Now it's spread literally throughout the country and in Port-au-Prince in a very short period of time. So it has two aspects of it. One, it can spread rapidly. And two, within an individual, they can get sick and die breathtakingly rapidly. I mean, if someone comes in and starts to feel badly, if they just happen to live a few hours from a hospital where they can get rehydration and they don't make it, they could literally die on the way to the hospital. And that's what they're seeing in such a tragic way
in Haiti
right now.
Sebastian Walker, how many hospitals are there in Haiti?
Well, the number of hospitals has obviously been severely restricted due to the devastating earthquake in January. It really had a huge impact on infrastructure throughout the country. What they've been doing now that the disease has really taken a toll is building temporary treatment centers known as CTCs, cholera treatment centers, to actually provide beds for the increased number of patients that they are expecting, especially in the capital, Port-au-Prince. One of the biggest concerns all along has really been the disease not only reaching Port-au-Prince, but starting to spread in those very large IDP camps where those large number of Haitians are still living more than 11 months after the earthquake. So one of the priorities the authorities have had is to try to get these centers up and running as quickly as possible to cope with the sheer number of patients that they expect. Now, during the whole political unrest period that's been going on since just shortly before the elections, which were held on the 28th of November, that's had a knock-on effect on the ability of health officials to try to deal with treating the disease. Some of those cholera treatment centers actually were forced to shut down over that period while you know, there were demonstrations and even the election itself was held. So it's had a severe impact on the treatment of the disease. And one of the things many Haitians have been saying is that, you know, this is not an ideal time to hold that kind of event while they're trying to deal with this full-blown humanitarian emergency. It's really set back the treatment of the disease somewhat.
And, I want to ask Professor Fatton about that political dispute, because in the midst of this enormous concern about cholera, you had this incredible dispute about a presidential election. Robert, if you would explain what's going on for us.
Well, good morning.
What's
happening is indeed that you have an electoral crisis. It is not something that is really surprising. If you look at past elections in Haiti, most of them during the election day itself and after the elections, you've had demonstrations, you've had protests, because the winners don't accept, obviously, that they've won, but the losers do not. And in the past election, in particular, as you put it, in a time of cholera and in the aftermath of an earthquake, the disorganization of the elections were massive. There was very low participation, even in terms of the numbers given by the Electoral Council, barely 25%. What happened is that during the election itself, on Sunday, November the 28th, at around 1 or 2 in the afternoon, all the candidates, except the candidate supported by President Préval, the governing party and the governing regime, as it were, decided that the elections were fraudulent, that they would not put up with that kind of elections, and they refused to continue to proceed. And suddenly, on Monday morning, two of the candidates, Michel Martelly, who's well known as Sweet Mickey, and Mirlan Maniga, decided actually that the elections were okay. There may have been irregularities, but they were fine. So you had three candidates who were ultimately accepting of the electoral process. But once the results were published, then you've had that crisis. And you have to put it in the context of the electoral system in Haiti. There is a first round, and the top two candidates, if no one gets 50%, will go to the second round. And here you have Mirlan Maniga, who was the leader of the PAC. She had about 30% of the vote. In second position came Jude Celestin, the candidate of the governing party. And in third position came Michel Martelly, with barely 14,000 votes separating him from Jude Celestin. And Martelly has decided that that is not going to be something that is acceptable. He sees himself as at least one of the two is going to go to the second round. Jude Celestin, for his part, has already declared that he is in the second round. And moreover, Jude Celestin says that the count was completely fraudulent, that he won the election outright with 52%. So you have positions that cannot easily be bridged. And you've had also very confusing signals from the international community. On the one hand, you hear the elections have been irregular, there have been gross fraud in some parts, but the elections are okay. Then you have the Organization of American States claiming that, well, this is a political crisis. Maybe there is a political solution to that crisis. The top three candidates should go forward to the second round. Then there is this the business of the Electoral Council recounting the vote. But two of the candidates, Martelly and Maniga, have decided that they were not going to accept that procedure. So there doesn't seem to be ground for a compromise. And if there is no compromise, one might fear that each of the candidates will start to put their people out in the streets, and that might escalate, unfortunately, into serious violence.
Well, so it sounds as though, given the situation in Haiti at the time of the election, with so many people living in squalid circumstances without true access to voting places, the question becomes, should the election have been held at all?
Well, I think that's a good question, because we knew way before the elections that there would be logistical problems. We knew way before the elections that the pattern in Haiti has been that elections are moments of great political volatility, and that those that any elections might, in fact, weaken the very weak institutions that we have. But the decision was made by the international community and by the government, and ultimately accepted very reluctantly by most of the candidates to participate in those elections. And the additional problem is that all the parties of the opposition have always looked at the Electoral Council as a vehicle of the current government. In other words, that the Electoral Council was biased. So we had a recipe for a real a disaster, and this is exactly what we've had.
Exactly.
And it's almost impossible to understand why the decision was made in those circumstances, especially after the epidemic of cholera.
All right.
But yeah.
And we have an email question which concerns both the medical and the political outlook there. The question is directed to Dr. Fauci. She says, I've been offered a job in Haiti and am considering it. However, I'm a single parent with a four-year-old child. I'm really worried about the cholera epidemic. I know it's manageable, but I'm worried about caring for my child while I would be at work all day and she would be with a caretaker. I was told there is a cholera vaccine. I had never heard such a thing before. Is this true? If so, is it safe? How could I ensure my child would be safe in such a context?
Well, first of all, putting things in context, there's an acute, serious situation right now in Haiti. How long it will go on and whether it will taper down and be under better control. For the CDC right now is putting out a travel warning for Haiti, which essentially says that only do essential travel. So if she's offered a job that she doesn't have to be at next week, I would consider that that's something that is not essential at this time. The question regarding vaccine, there is not a vaccine approved here in the United States for cholera, but there are two vaccines that are being considered for usage. One of them has been pre-qualified by the WHO, and it is available in 60 countries. Another one is from India and, in fact, has been used in India, but is not yet, but is awaiting pre-qualification from the WHO. So there are vaccines that are available, and there has been a push to start using vaccines. There was first the consideration that there was a low supply of it, but now we know there's likely more than we thought there was.
Here's an email from Ramon in Cape Coral, Florida, who says, you could say that I just don't understand all the facts, and I would agree, but how can this be happening so close to our own shores and a very large Haitian population in South Florida? How can they not have enough water to hydrate? How is it that medicine so desperately needed is not being distributed and used? Is it the Haitian government does not care? Is it the UN inability to manage? I just do not understand. Sebastian, how do you see it?
Well, I think that's a very good question, and it's a question that many Haitians are asking all of the time. I mean, if you think about what the threat is here of this very serious disease raging around the country, and really, I mean, cholera is a treatable disease. If you have access to clean water, drinkable water, then it's not a life-threatening situation. If you can rehydrate yourself, then there are the chances of actually dying as a result of cholera go right down. But the thing is that in these large IDP camps, people have very little access to any kind of potable water. We did a story recently looking at the accessibility people have to fresh drinking water, and I mean, there are deliveries of water that go on, but, you know, four times a day there are trucks coming around to IDP camps, certain IDP camps, not all of them. Many people actually don't even get that. But the water that's being delivered, and this is delivery from major NGOs who are organizing this, NGOs like the American Red Cross, for example, the water that's being distributed isn't good quality enough for people to drink. We spoke to the country director for the American Red Cross, who told us that, yeah, look, if the families in these camps want to drink this water, they have to boil it first. There's so much chlorine that they have to put in these supplies of water that by the time it gets distributed in camps, it's not potable water. He was saying that the only way for Haitians to have access to potable water is to buy bottled water. Mm. And the cost of that is about half a dollar. Many Haitians are living on less than $2 a day, so it's simply not possible. And given the amount of resources that have been available and the time that these major NGOs have had and the donations that many people across the world have actually given to help improve the situation in Haiti, the question of why this situation in terms of delivery of water that people can actually drink isn't happening, I think, is a very valid one, and it's one that many Haitians are asking all the time as this disease threatens the country.
Sebastian Walker, he's Haiti-based reporter for Al Jazeera English. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's open the phones to Westchester, Ohio. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning. My son and his two oldest sons, aged 16 and 14, are going to Haiti to help build houses on December 28th, and I'm very worried about them. If cholera is a bacterial infection, are antibiotics not effective against cholera?
Dr. Fauci.
Antibiotics are effective in decreasing the length of time that you're sick and decreasing some of the excretion of the bacteria. But really, the primary way to treat cholera is to, as we've said several times on the show, is to replenish the lost fluid by rehydration. It is not recommended at all that people who go there take prophylactic antibiotics, be what the caller is referring to. That is not recommended. People who go down there are recommended by the CDC to bring bottled water to be able to have a chlorine
tablets.
And to have a prescription with you for antibiotics in case you get sick.
But how are you going to get a prescription filled?
Get a prescription. Bring it down.
Oh,
get a prescription.
Okay. Gotcha.
Bring it down, but don't use it prophylactically. Use it if you get sick.
But how much good is it going to do once you get sick?
Well, once you get sick, the best way to counter that is to rehydrate.
it is clear that antibiotics can be part of the regimen of treatment by lessening the duration of being sick. But it's not the primary way. It's rehydration.
Back to you, Robert Fatone. From a political point of view, how safe will Elizabeth's sons be?
It's difficult to tell, because if there is no resolution of the current impasse, one can envisage a certain amount of trouble. On the other hand, traditionally, Christmas time in Haiti has led to some sort of a weakening of protest. But we are in a very different historical juncture, where obviously you have the elections, you have discontent with the elections, you have discontent with the government after the earthquake.
And what about the peacekeepers? Might they be at risk because of the suspicion of where the cholera has come from?
Yes, I think that's part of it. And I think it's also part of a growing nationalist feeling in Haiti, that the international community, that the peacekeepers have been in Haiti for a number of years, and the situation has not improved. So the question is, from Haitians in Haiti, what in the heck are they doing? So there is great suspicion about the ultimate motivation of the international community.
Robert Fatone, he's politics professor, associate dean for graduate programs at the University of Virginia. He's the author of Haiti's Predatory Republic and The Roots of Haitian Despotism. We'll take a short break. More calls when we come back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org, by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org, and by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR.
Emmy Award-winning talk show host Dick Cavett on interviewing some of the icons of the last century, his struggle with depression, and why he loves his new opinion blog, The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. We'll go right to the phones. Let's go to Kobe in Utica, New York. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I just want to make a comment, possibly a question. I have family in Haiti, and I'm hearing widespread reports about supplies through donations actually being withheld from the people there. My question is, why are these supplies purposely being withheld, which can possibly prevent the spread of cholera? And also, is it possible that cholera was actually brought into the nation for some means of, I don't know, population control or something?
Oh, boy. What a sad speculation. Robert Fatone, you have actually written that you think international aid groups may be a cause of many of Haiti's problems. Would you go so far as to agree with what our caller has said?
No, I would doubt that that would be the case, but there are speculations precisely about the introduction of the cholera epidemic through the peacekeepers, and that has flamed tensions between Haitians and the international community. On the other hand, I think that there is a point about the unintended negative consequences of foreign assistance. In particular, when you look at what has been happening for the past 30 or 40 years, what the policies of the foreign countries which have been giving foreign assistance to Haiti has been, is to really bypass the state and to put their money with NGOs. And that has meant that the state has really been weakened to such an extent that it is now a non-functioning state. And you can see that with the earthquake and with the cholera epidemic. The state has no longer the capacity to do what it is supposed to do in a society. So that's one of the major consequences of that emphasis on NGOs. And Haitians increasingly see the NGOs as, on the one hand, helping to some extent, but in the long term, contributing to deeper problems.
Interesting.
And the question that one of your listeners was asking about how come we can have such degree of poverty in Haiti while we are so close to the United States. I think this question has really captured the essence of the crisis in Haiti. What you've had traditionally is a very sick society, a society in Haiti that is deeply polarized between a small minority of fairly wealthy people and an overwhelming majority of poor people. The poor people have traditionally been excluded from the moral community of the minority. In Haiti, there is a word in Creole which says moun en dehors, which means the people outside. And the people in the camps, the people in the rural areas which are affected by the crisis, are people who are not considered full citizens yet by a significant number of powerful people. And the treatment that vast majority of people has been receiving is something that is part of that crisis, that exclusionary kind of society. And not surprisingly, the consequences are dire.
And tell me about the billions of dollars in aid that was pledged to Haiti after the earthquake, Robert. How much of it actually got to the people and the various projects that it was supposed to go to?
Well, very little of that money has been invested in Haiti. And one of the problems is clearly that if the political situation continues to deteriorate, it's unlikely that you're going to see much of that money. And if you look at many countries that have been affected by similar crisis, the pledges, and there was a pledge of $5 billion, it is estimated that in general, if you get about 55 to 60% of that money, you're doing very well. So it is highly unlikely, given the political situation, given the problems in Haiti, that you're going to have a full commitment of that money to the country.
All right. I'll go back to the phones to Boston, Massachusetts. Good morning, CJ.
Hi, Diane. I was born and raised here in Boston, but I've traveled to Haiti a number of times to do sustainable agricultural work. And one of the things I've always observed is that, for the most part, Haitians do not drink, you know, water out of the streams. They drink these little bags of water or bottled water. And where this cholera did not break out in the camps, it actually broke out in, you know, many other areas where I know, where I've served, and the people always drank these little bags of water. It questions me as to whether the very source of it was in these, you know, prepackaged bags. And the second part of my comment or question is, in reference to the election, I'm really surprised that the international community chose to go with the election in this way, as opposed to instead, you know, creating the infrastructure necessary for a well-counted election, like maybe doing a country census first, issuing government, you know, IDs or social security numbers that could then be easily counted when an election is performed.
All right. And Sebastian, I'll go to you first on those prepackaged bags of water.
Yeah, I mean, certainly in the urban areas, that's how you see the majority of Haitians getting their water. But I think, I mean, it's really in the rural areas that a lot of the focus has been in terms of tracing the source of this disease. In places like the Artibonite region, where most of those cases first appeared, there are many Haitians in these small towns and villages whose only access to water is through those local water systems. And the fact that they have been contaminated with the disease means that, you know, the risks are very, very high for Haitians living in these places. One of the biggest impacts of Hurricane Thomas, the very serious storm which passed very close to Port-au-Prince a few weeks ago, was the flooding that it caused in those areas, and the fact that rivers that could be carrying the disease burst their banks and flooded into homes really only served to exacerbate the spread of this disease. So I think the focus really has been on those water systems and just how badly they have been contaminated by the disease.
Dr. Fauci, I'm sorry, Sebastian.
No, that's okay.
Yeah, I agree completely. You know, as was mentioned, the Artibonite River region is clearly a major source of what's going on. In fact, if you look at the cases, a high percentage of the cases are coming from that particular region. It's throughout all of the 10 departments, including Port-au-Prince. But the focus and the concentration was within an area where people actually drink water literally from the river.
And Robert, on that election part of the question.
Well, I think that the international community was committed to the elections because the current government's term, President Préval, has to be out of office on February 7, 2011. I think that was obviously not necessarily the best resolution of the problem. I would have advocated, actually, a national conference immediately after the earthquake, whereby all of the grassroots organizations in Haiti, the political parties, would have come together and hopefully generated a government of national unity. That was not the road taken. Once you take the road of the elections, you are bound to have problems, as I've said. And I think the international community, which has put a lot of money in those elections, something like $35 million, ultimately miscalculated. They had assumed that those elections could take place and that the elections would lead to the creation of a legitimate government. And as far as I can see, whomever is elected, given the context of the current crisis, is going to be, to some extent, illegitimate, and it's going to be a very weak government. So we haven't resolved anything with elections that are so that have been so bad. But this is a problem that we've had for the last 20 years or so.
Yes.
The international community says the elections are bad, but they are okay. So you have a standard to judge the elections that is really a standard of mediocrity.
All right. And what about, as many people are wondering, what about a chance of a cholera outbreak here in the United States, Dr. Fauci?
The chances of that are extraordinarily low, in fact, vanishingly small. And the reason is, as we've heard throughout the discussion on the show, is that really the driving force and the fundamental matrix of the causation is poor sanitary conditions and lack of clean drinking water. We have and will continue to see rarely a sporadic case of cholera in the United States, usually imported. Someone who comes from a different country has a case, gets sick, but doesn't spread it because we don't have the poor sanitary conditions and we have plenty of access to water. Also, there have been an occasional mini outbreak from maybe a family that would bring in from food that can get contaminated.
And here's a question on that very subject. Scott, I gather you're planning to go to Haiti tomorrow. Is that correct?
I'm a journalist. And my question was, I mean, I got four shots last Thursday. I can barely move my arm. But as far as
eating food down there. We're flying in with a bunch of our own supplies. But is it even safe to go to one of the restaurants there? I was back there in June, and we ate at a restaurant, and, you know, didn't have any issues. I'm very, very aware of, you know, the water and all that. And then we also were given prophylactic antibiotics for malaria. Is that something I even should be taking?
Well, first of all, with regard to cholera, as I mentioned to one of the other callers, that antibiotics can be used in cholera, but is not recommended to do it prophylactically. With regard to eating food, you'd have to really get information locally about the restaurants. I mean, there's no way that I could say, or anybody could say over the phone, oh, it's okay to just go to any restaurant and have food, because you don't know what the sanitary conditions. I would assume that you'll get guidance to go to a restaurant in which it's very clear that bottled water is used for the washing of food, et cetera. And food itself is not contaminated. But on a case-by-case basis, you'd have to really get information and intelligence while you're down there.
Sebastian, what was your experience eating in restaurants before you left to go to Qatar?
Well, it's really fine. I mean, we had no kind of precautions, really, that we would take. I mean, we've been traveling extensively throughout the Artibonite region, you know, visiting these hospitals at the very center of the outbreak, going around speaking to patients, you know, really getting into those areas where the disease is raging. As long as you take the basic precautions of, you know, using hand sanitizer and washing your hands thoroughly, basic hygiene steps that really, even if you're applying those in these areas where there is poor sanitation, can really help to reduce the disease. One of the main problems that authorities are facing is really getting the message out to those patients who really are the ones most at risk. I think they are the ones we really need to be focused on, rather than you know, foreign journalists and humanitarian aid workers. It's really, I mean, the threat of this disease taking hold in the camps is huge. But so long as you take those basic hygiene steps of using hand sanitizer, having access to some potable water, it really hasn't been a huge concern for us. And we've been reporting from around the country in these disease-infested areas for, ever since this crisis started.
Sebastian Walker. He's a Haiti-based reporter for Al Jazeera English. He's been there since shortly after the January 12th earthquake. He is joining us this morning from Qatar. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Sebastian, when do you plan to go back to Haiti?
Well, in about a week's time from now, actually. We've, as you said, had this bureau functioning since January. Really, the decision was to, you know, not only follow this extremely powerful human story, but, you know, really monitor how the reconstruction effort has been proceeding. And it's interesting, some of the questions from your callers kind of, you know, curious about the effectiveness of where this donated money and the NGO work is going, and, you know, why there hasn't been more progress. That's something that we've been really following very closely ever since the January earthquake. And I think it's a huge concern on the ground. The rate of progress really isn't as good as it should be. And I think a lot of questions have to be asked about not only the work that these major NGOs are doing, but where the money is going. This is something that we've been monitoring on the ground. And, you know, even now, it's more than 11 months after the earthquake, if you go to these camps, you know, some of them are in much the same way as they were in January. There are families who are living under the same tarpaulins that they received back in January and the same tents. And, you know, these materials are starting to wear very thin, and we're approaching the one-year anniversary since this devastating earthquake occurred.
So you really have to wonder, where has the money gone that they have received, Sebastian?
Well, absolutely. And I think really it's a problem that's bedeviled Haiti in, you know, years leading up to the earthquake. It's not as if Haiti hasn't been a recipient of large amounts of foreign aid money in the past, but I think the system whereby you have literally thousands of NGOs on the ground all kind of working against each other to some extent really means that progress can be very slow.
What do you mean when you say they're working against each other? What do you mean?
Well, I mean, the coordination between groups, I think, is not at the level that it should be. And really, it's the system whereby you have these NGOs stepping into the roles that would traditionally be carried out by the state. The tools of the state have been chipped away in the years leading up to the earthquake, and in their place, you've got NGOs, you know, stepping into those gaps. And, you know, the whole concept that NGOs are going to, you know, take the place of a government system that would have, you know, a coordinated approach to getting things done on the ground really isn't going to work. If you have, you know, donated money that's being stored up by different groups, and then each of those groups has a different strategy of how the money should be spent. If you're talking about the sheer number of these groups on the ground, there's no way to coordinate that effectively, and it just means that progress is often very, very slow.
And unfortunately, I think we'll have to leave it there, but people are asking about the best place to donate money. Should it be Doctors Without Borders?
Partners in Health.
And Partners in Health, and yet you've still got this conflict among these various groups. Dr. Anthony Fauci, he's director of the NIH's National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Robert Fatone, Jr., politics professor at the University of Virginia. Sebastian Walker of Al Jazeera English. He is the Haiti-based reporter. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.